The theme of the morning seems to be trees and wildfires. Today, we are continuing our series on fires in Minnesota forests, thanks to our producer, Mark Jacobs, who joins us now. He's bringing along his guest, our guest, Travis Vertigan from the Minnesota DNR. He's Fire Predictive Services Coordinator, talking today with us about the criteria involved in determining areas of increased forest fire risk. Travis, Mark, thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Fire Predictive Services. That's a that's a daunting title.
Yeah.
Explain a little bit about that. That's kind of a, I don't think I'd want to be that person.
Well, yeah, it's a complex job, and it seems like the further I get into my career, the harder it is to explain. But kind of putting it as simply as I can, I'm in a position where I help to support people's decisions, specifically related to the fire environment and the things that go into whether we're seeing increased fire potential or decreases in fire potential. And that exists all across all sorts of scales of time and space, right? So
yeah.
Are we going to have fires today? Are we going to have a drought this fall? All these things are part of the dynamic nature of what I have to assess on a regular basis.
So you're looking at humidity and temperature and the greenness of the environment, wind direction,
yep.
I suspect, all of these things. But still, that doesn't really, I mean, any place can burn, I would think.
Yeah, just give it time. Any part of the natural environment can be flammable. So we typically will categorize these things that are impactful to us into weather fuels. So the weather being the temperature, humidity, winds that you talked about. A lot of people recognize that part of it. The fuels component is one where people understand, like, wet stuff doesn't burn, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you've ever tried to start a campfire with wet wood from the forest, it's not as easy as kiln-dried kindling and firewood, you know? But really, there's a whole spectrum across that of what impacts our fuels. And then the other thing that we consider is geography. So things like parcelization, land use patterns. a lot of these things will carry over and they'll impact each other. So large-scale weather patterns, for instance, are the things that shape our natural environment. They're the reasons we have a prairie and a forest, and we have this kind of tension zone that we see from the northwest part of Minnesota down to the southeast. And that's weather driven, but it's actually impacting our fuels. So even with those three categories, we still get a lot of bleed over in terms of how to consider things.
Now, your job is to sort of assemble all of this data and then alert the people who are responsible for fighting fires or even setting fires in the case where you would have a controlled burn. Go ahead.
Yeah, I support decisions across the spectrum here. So there is beneficial fire, like you're saying, in terms of prescribed fires that are used to promote, you know, valuable ecosystems that people like for either, you know, game species like pheasant or non-game species like songbirds. But then on the flip side, fire is destructive and damaging and has a pretty immense effect on values, you know, we call them values at risk. People value their property, their homes, their livelihoods, all those things. So the simplest way that I think I could maybe relate to folks what I do with our fire managers is imagine a scenario where the weatherman would tell you you may need a umbrella, right? Well, I think everybody can agree that it's worthwhile keeping an umbrella in your car. The problem that we have with firefighting resources, so the planes, the trucks, the people, is they're limited and they all run out of gas. And we have to play the long game because we know we're going to continue to be exposed to risk. So I can't just tell everybody to have a firefighter in your backyard because that's just not possible. So what we try to do is take the resources that we do have and be as targeted as we can to be effective and efficient in the deployment of those resources to protect the values at risk.
When you're out there making these decisions about where to put people, what is at risk, are there areas where a fire might start and you might just say, you know what, this one we can let it burn because it's beneficial? Or does that happen?
It does, I think. So I support decisions for people across the broad array of public agencies that are responsible for fire management, all the way from the local fire department and, up to statewide programs like emergency management, and even beyond at the national scale, because all of this coordination happens at all these different scales. So depending on a specific agency's values that they have, those beneficial fires where they could be let to burn, you could kind of weigh things out. So even if you let a fire burn and it's going to be a net positive for the environment, right? There's always the consideration of what's that smoke going to do. And I think we are all kind of familiar with that smoke, what that smoke does when these fires get big enough now here lately. So it's always kind of this give and take and really looking for what is the greatest net benefit, regardless of the situation.
So what are some of the high risk areas, either in the state or in the northeastern part where we are, and why are they high risk?
Yeah, so Mark initially reached out to me. The timing was really well timed with the fires that we saw this spring up in the Northeast. Those fires were driven by factors that we have a fairly good understanding of. They're short of the weather, because the weather changes so quickly, right? But we can see the patterns develop for days at a time. At the time, the whole state was at risk. We had spring fuels, which are just all of our dead fuels from last summer, that's growth, right? So the whole state was at risk. And again, going with the timing, Mark was telling me, and I was communicating some things about more recent events, the blowdown over by Bemidji. That represents a massive change on a broad scale, and an area of concern in the state for us. Not so much right now. It's been raining enough that we don't have what I would call a big fire problem, but we got to consider the rest of the fire season, which is basically until snow falls.
Yeah, that is something to consider. Now, because of this, I mean, when you have a windstorm or you have that kind of an event take place on the terrain, a lot of that is going to get, moved, chipped, cut up, hauled away. Does that reduce the risk of fire because you've suddenly taken all that fuel out of the equation? Or do you increase the fire because you've now added some dead materials that were alive and green prior to this windstorm?
Yeah, that's kind of the catch-22 of trying to mitigate risk. Is if we went in, for instance, with salvage logging operations and took out all the heavy fuels, we'd still have all the branches and the needles and everything. And those are going to be drying out and susceptible to the conditions that we would expect to see in a dry fall. Where even the stuff that's green right now will start to die out once we get those first couple of frosts. And that fall period is actually historically kind of our highest risk or highest potential when we look at historical records. But we don't always see the highest number of fires during that time period.
Is there an explanation? I mean, I would have thought I would have thought spring, coming out of the winter, snow melt, everything's dry, all that dead grass, all those, I would have thought that would be far more dangerous than say fall. Is there some reason?
Yes. Well, I mean, some of this is relative to how you look at it. So think about spring, everything's dead, like you mentioned. But if you actually just walk out in the woods, even on a really dry day in the spring, and stick your hands down in the soil, you're going to find cool. You're going to find moisture and things like that. Those are things that limit a fire's potential. So in the spring, it's like a flash in the pan kind of thing. We can have a 5,000 acre fire go through grass, and once it's out, it's out. The issue with like summertime or like late summer or fall fires is they're primarily driven by drought. So if you walk out to that same place in the woods and stick your hand down in the soil, it's going to feel warm and dry compared to what it was like in the spring. So fires can get started really easily in the spring. They can spread rapidly, but their impacts are limited by what we typically see in that overwinter recovery in our soils.
Are you then, as part of your data gathering, are you looking at soil moistures? And I suppose it related to rainfall, but do you actually have data that says, you know, the soils are dry and this is a dangerous time?
Yeah, we will look at any information we can get. We do have a couple of fire danger rating systems that we use that do some of the indices from those systems. They're multifaceted. Will give an indication for level of dryness in the soil. So we can watch those types of things to answer those specific questions, but that might not tell us how dry the fuels above the soil are. So we have a different indice that we'll look at, and that'll tell us how easily fires can start.
So are you having like these giant computer models that say this area is in danger, this area is not so dangerous? With all of these factors that are considered, I mean, if I were sitting there and reading through this, by the time I got done reading, you know, a lot of that stuff might have already burned away. Are you aided with computers in this kind of stuff?
For sure. I mean, but if you think about the complexities that go into weather forecasting and modeling, those are, you know, the Weather Service has the big models, right? I've got a degree in forestry. So I'm not a climatologist. I'm not a meteorologist. I do analysis on information that I do have. So how big the models are, I guess, are also kind of a matter of scale too. So I'm not predicting climate trends or anything like that. But if you give me a set of information and it gives me some indication of what the fire environment is either like right now or maybe like, you know, 6 months from now, I can give you a pretty good assessment for what that would mean from a fire management standpoint.
What does it look like? What does your data set look like when you look over these things? What are you what springs out on if you picked up a page of data right now, what would be the three or four things that you would want to check right away to make sure that, boy, those are high or those are low or.
Mm-hmm. So really what we're talking about is this concept of alignment of forces. And so when I look at what may be likely for this fall or late summer, the information that I see that's given to me out of these great big computer models is that we have an increased likelihood for above normal temperatures and below normal precipitation. And that really actually favors the northwest part of the state more than any other part of the state at this point. So when we talk about alignment of forces, we just had the blowdown. Now we've got fresh fuels that are in a position along with the timing of when they became fuels, basically. lining up together. So if we have this hot, dry situation along with some fuels and we see some significant fire days, so some windier days come along with that, along with a source for ignition, it's kind of a recipe for disaster, right? And those are the things that I'm seeing right now. So even though it's been raining, this is great. Like this in the short term, we're sitting in a great spot. But if the faucet turns off, that's when we really need to start watching out.
So you get an area where you have a blowdown. Now, this last one happened in Bemidji. A lot of it was in the town or around people's homes. A lot of that gets cleaned up and hauled away. If that just happens in the forest, let's say, and that stuff gets blown down and you don't go in and clean it up, how long is it before that fuel becomes a problem? I mean, we all know, like you said, it's tough to burn green, but how long is it before? Is it 6 months? Is it 6 weeks? Is it 6 years? When does that fuel really become a concern for you guys?
Yeah, so the answer is all of the above. And the reason being is we classify fuels into scales of, you know, fineness. So basically, how fast can they dry out? The needles are going to dry out this year for sure. I've already heard they're red. And probably ready to start burning with more flammability. Whereas like the boles of the trees, you know, the 12-inch logs or whatever they may be, just like firewood, it's going to take a while for that to dry out. So that may be on the scale of more like 6 years, and these finer fuels are basically almost immediately. As soon as they dry out to the point where they can burn, they're a problem.
Wow. Yeah.
We are almost out of time, but Travis, do you have hope for the future when it comes to...
Oh, for sure. Yes.
Yeah, reducing wildfire loss.
There are a lot of good things that are happening. We've learned a lot since we started to mature as firefighting agencies. You know, we're a relatively young organization. Organized suppression didn't really start until like the 1910s, 19-teens. And that has evolved over time. There's been some monumental shifts that stand out from others. And we have the technology and the data and the people and everything that we need to further decision support. That doesn't mean there's not barriers. There's definitely barriers, but we are understanding what those barriers are and doing everything that we can to remove them, whether that's a structural barrier with like poor data. We're getting better and better at improving our data, or anything along those lines. I mean, it's one of the hardest parts of my job I'm finding is that I'm trying to communicate to everyone, and fire behavior, for as complex as it is far less complex than human behavior. So I have to try to figure out how to take all this knowledge that I have now and explain it in a way that everyone can understand. And that's really the exciting part for me more recently in my career, is finding better and better ways to do that.
Well, thanks, Travis and Mark. Once again, thanks for setting up this conversation. Travis Vertigan, Minnesota DNR Fire Predictive Services Coordinator. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Travis.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
I don't envy you your job.
I don't envy you yours.
Yeah, well,
we'll keep doing what we're doing.
All right, that sounds good. I'm glad you're on it.
Yep. Yeah, just invite me back anytime you want to know more.
All right, we will.
Thanks so much.